Welcome to episode number 4 of the Dream Freedom Beauty Podcast. Today, we're talking with astrologer Channie Nicholas. Channie shares her view on how astrology can be a healing tool and what role healers play in helping others heal themselves. We talk about the Lilith myth, the power of knowing where we came from, and the power of declarations to help us move out of the old and grow into the new. Finally, Channie clarifies how connecting with nature can deepen your understanding of astrology.
We're your hosts, sisters Natalie
and Lizzie Ross.
Dream Freedom Beauty is a podcast for free spirits who yearn to connect deeply with their intuition and manifest their dream lives in harmony with the earth.
You can find the podcast show notes at dreamfreedombeauty.com. Hello, beautiful listeners. We're here with another episode of Dream Freedom Beauty with Channie Nicholas, an LA-based astrologer. Channie's work is rooted in queer and feminist theory. She holds a BA in Integral Studies from CIIS and a degree in feminist counseling. Channie devotes her spare time to studying, practicing, and supporting restorative justice practices. Channie, thank you so much for coming on the show. We are so delighted to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I love this quote that I read from you recently. All of us have the responsibility to extend ourselves to help, love, and create spaces for justice in our lives, in our communities, and in the world. And today I just want to jump right in to your perspective as an astrologer. Can you tell us a little bit about what astrology does for the individual and the community?
Well, I think if astrology is practiced well, and that the astrologers are, you know, self-reflective, curious beings that are willing to learn and grow and challenge themselves and learn about people and life and the way many different types of people live life. I think that astrology for the individual can be healing because it's a beautiful tool for reflection. That being a human being is such a conundrum and such a matrix and such a paradox. And it can be such a painful at times experience to be in a human body, to be carrying around human emotions, to be trying to think and reason and make sense of life. And astrology offers us a tool of reflection of why it is we work in the ways that we do or possible reasons for it. And if, as long as we view our own charts as kind of like living, breathing entities where we're not pinned down to any one specific kind of outcome, although I do think that there is room for fate in the discussion, but as long as we can see kind of multiple ways of living out our chart and our life and being a human being, considering these factors, then it can be this remarkable tool for healing. And, you know, I don't know if I ever thought of astrology as a tool for community, because when I, you know, began studying astrology a million years ago, there was no such thing as the internet. And I didn't have that experience of growing up where you could Google something or where you could be talking to thousands, millions, billions of people across the planet about something. And so I, you know, I studied books, whatever books I could get my hands on. A lot of them are really difficult. It was like feminism and astrology wasn't, it was like these really obscure things. But like if I had, you know, like being introduced to bell hooks back in the 90s was like a big deal because she wasn't on the internet. There wasn't YouTube videos of, you know, there, those kind of principles, those thoughts, those schools of thinking, they were more underground and you really had to be introduced by somebody to them. And so astrology as a means for community, it's like there's an obvious kind of connection in terms of pagan rituals that are connected to the earth cycles, that are connected to the light, to the solstices, to the equinoxes. There's that, but I wasn't a part of that. So I guess what I can say about community and astrology as I've experienced it over, especially over the past 10 years, especially over the past five, six, when social media has really just like come into a whole new form and a new importance, I think, and level of participation in our lives, is that, you know, like I know a lot of people that sit and read my horoscopes or other people's like in community.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I've experienced that firsthand.
Yeah, like at their jobs, they like make everybody, you know, read their horoscope, where they all get together on Sunday night or Monday morning and read the horoscope. And I hear a lot about how nice it is for groups of people and community. So, I mean, that makes me feel like, you know, there are certain things that make everything worthwhile. And that is one of them for me. And also to have, you know, also, again, with the internet, that when something tragic happens in the world, that we all have a way of responding to it. And my way is through an astrological lens sometimes, if it's not... if it's appropriate. And so that's another way that I can be in contact and build community in a sense, kind of on a global scale around a conversation, and how I can use my tool to be in conversation. If there's any light that I can shed, again, if it's appropriate, then that's what I have to use in the community, in whatever community that is.
Hmm. Excellent. Do you have a story of a time when you really came to trust your ability to interpret charts through astrology or to use your intuition? It can be through astrology or just to use your intuition in general.
Yeah, so the topic of intuition is really interesting in terms of the way I practice now, because a couple years ago, I forced myself to learn traditional astrology, which is an amalgamation of practices that happened for a couple thousand years, and then we lost a lot of it, and then we came up with a new system, in a sense, which is modern Western astrology, and then the traditional astrology has been resurfacing. So I embarked upon learning about that, and my teacher, Demetra George, said, you know, she looked at my chart, and she read an interview that I had done, and she was like, I get it. You're really intuitive, and you probably have been operating on that for a long time, but you're going to put that aside for a moment, and we're going to learn some rules and structure, and then you're going to add in the intuition after. Mm. So it was actually a really big relief to just learn common sense rules that were really, they were rooted philosophically in a really, into a really deep tradition that is like, you know, thousands and thousands of years old. So that's part of the way I work is that. And then what I can say about intuition is that for me, it works, it generally works through a state of dreaming. Mm. And so when I dream, I often, especially if I'm not in times of my life where I was, where I'd moved away from the astrology, I would get really intense dreams that, you know, the planets would kind of like yell at me. They tend to harass me. Not always very nice, like entities to bump into when you're sleeping. Mm. But they would come in and be really like domineering and very forceful and demand that I listen to them. Mm. And then, you know, it would go away sometimes, then come back. And then there are times where I'll have different like planetary objects, like asteroids, talk to me directly and tell me things. Like things that I didn't even know existed. And then like they'll tell me like, go look this up. And then I'll go look it up and it'll be like precisely. Like one time I had that happen. I woke up to this voice yelling at me, go look at Asclepius in your chart. And so I did. I didn't even know Asclepius was an asteroid at that point. And I pulled it up. And of course, it's exactly on my sun. And Asclepius is one of the healers of the Greco-Roman pantheon, but he also has a very distinct connection to dreaming and psychic dreaming. Ooh. And getting messages through dreams or the ways in which people would heal and dream temples and all of that. So those are things that I had that were that I couldn't ignore, you know, things that how would happen like that to me that I couldn't ignore. But when I'm actively working, I don't, you know, I was just talking about this on a Facebook group of astrologers, and I was like, I don't even know anymore when I'm working what's intuition and what's not, because I work with a symbolic language. Mm. So there are rules that I work with, but within those, because now I have this really strong structure, the intuition is woven in, I think, so seamlessly in a way that I'm not sure I could even distinguish them at this point, nor if I want to. In a sense, in certain ways I do, but in other ways, it's nice when they start to hold hands.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. So having that, what did having that framework do for you on a deeper level? I mean, you say it's all kind of blended together, but what else did it do for you?
Well, it gave me, for me, modern astrology was always really, it was hard for me to get a hold of in a sense. And I could do it because I could grapple around with my intuition, but I could never find rules that I really liked that I could stick to. And so getting a set of rules, it's like, you know, if you become a painter and you want to understand how to work with shapes, you can go on your intuition about it, but it's also really wonderful to get trained around what shapes do what. Anyways, so when I had that framework, it gave me all the confidence I kind of needed that I was missing for so long, like 20 years in astrological learning. Then finally this came in and I was like, oh yeah, this is my way. And that's the most important thing, I think, with whatever we do. Doesn't matter what profession we're in, we have to find our way to be with it. Because whatever we do, I really believe we already know how to do it, but there might be like something we need to remember or something we need to add or some way in which we drive the vehicle that we are driving this time around. We have to drive it in the way that works best for us, or get in the right vehicle or whatever symbol we want to use. But I just had to find my own specific way of working with the material. And I also had to wait for the material to arrive in public domain because it was absent.
Oh, interesting.
For so long.
Yeah.
It wasn't around 20 years ago. Just, but it was, you know, it was more secret.
It seems like, and when you speak about intuition, it's a theme across the board that it's something where I'm not necessarily learning to do, but remembering how to do. I like that you bring that up.
Yeah. And that's also like in context of finding our path and our purpose and like what we're supposed to do in the world. I think that is something that we know inherently. There's something ingrained in us that we are here to do. And it's our job to find out what that is and then how we specifically need to do that thing. And I think it's really different and unique for everybody, and that there's no right way to do something. But when we find our way to do it, then, you know, the rubber hits the road and we can really go. Mm.
So, Chani, you are speaking about the individual gifts that we each have to offer the world. And I wanted to ask you, what do you feel are your greatest gifts that you give your readers as an astrologer? And are they things that you were aware of when you first started out, or did you gradually become aware of how you were helping people?
Gods, I don't know. I honestly feel like it's none of my business. You know what I mean? Like,
I love it. Yeah.
I honestly feel like the part that I can take credit for is that I show up. Mm-hmm. I show up and do the work. And I show up to be a container for the work. And I really honestly believe that the work is something that has nothing to do with me in a sense. Like,
yeah.
I feel like it's very much not like I'm there and I'm with it and I'm present and I think really deeply about stuff and I'm really critical and I'm really, when the work really works, I think it has nothing to do with, I think it's the only thing that I've done well is gotten out of the way.
Amen.
I don't know.
Yeah. I feel my experience of writing songs is really similar, frankly.
It would be weird to take credit for it in a way.
And I'm almost hesitant to take credit for it because I'm like, no, you're not mine. Don't go away. Come back.
No, but
we can just do this.
But like Chani said, you show up, and like that's, you know, I've often thought about this. Like, is there just all this stuff floating out there available for anyone to tap into, and you just showed up to tap into it?
It's like Bob Dylan. Have you read his Chronicles?
No.
He talks about the years where the songs just flooded in. They were like hanging like rain droplets in the air, and he just walked by and got like splashed with them. And he was like, these aren't his words, but this is how I interpreted it. He was just like, anybody could have grabbed those songs out of the air. They were just sitting there. And so he's like, they're his songs, of course, as an artist, you have to show up and be the instrument, and you have to tune yourself and take care of your instrument and practice and do all that stuff. But at the end of the day, there's that thing that comes through you that I strongly believe is none of my business how it works. I don't understand it. I don't know why it works. I don't know why it resonates with people. I don't know what is healing. I just trust to do it, and people seem to like it, and that's about all I can really think about it.
Mm-hmm. And that's enough. It works.
Yeah.
Interesting. So as a counselor and as an astrologer, I can imagine you've had to learn and develop good boundaries. I mean, that being said, you know, if you're opening yourself up to this, you're also going to have to say yes and no to things. How has that impacted your life and your use of your intuition?
Boundaries are really important. The busier I am, the more important they are. There's a certain, Dimitra George says, there's like a certain amount of inspiration for each reading. And you know when the inspiration's gone. It's like writing a song, right? You know you're on it. It's like writing a horoscope. You're on it. You're something. And then it goes. And you're like, okay, well, that's it.
Yep.
And so there's trust you have to develop with your inner barometer and your inner gas tank and your inner intuition bank. And then when it's gone, it's gone. And it needs to go. And in terms of having, you know, good boundaries with people, that I really honestly believe, like, everyone themselves, you know how to heal. Like, your what you need, you already have. And if I can do anything, it's just to be someone who holds space for that to occur. Because I do believe we need each other to hold space. I can't hold that for myself. I need to go to somebody who can give me a space to reflect in and give me some reflections. But I know that as someone who works with people in a therapeutic way, that I have to believe that they have the answer for themselves. And that my job is to allow them the space and the information that I have to help create a connection to that salve, to that healing, to that truth, to that thing that they need to get to. And I do that as a friend, right? And I try to let other people do that for me as a friend, and that we are partners in this situation.
Oh, interesting. So in the way that you hold space is through astrology, and I'm wondering, can you explain how astrology is more than just like I was born when the stars were in this arrangement? Like how would you explain how astrology holds that space for people?
To someone who was not familiar.
Like, what is an astrology reading?
Well, you know, I'm thinking, because you're saying you show up and you hold that space as a friend and you kind of provide some information. And so how does astrology provide that information, and how is it more than, like, it's so mystical. I mean, it seems so, like.
Okay. So maybe friend isn't the right word, but, like, as somebody who's on the path to.
Or like a guide.
I'm not into, like, being the expert on somebody else's life, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I want to give people that power back when they come to see me, because I am the expert on astrology in that moment, but you're the expert on your life when you come to see me. So I have a piece of the puzzle and you have a piece of it. You know yourself better than anybody else, but I also know your astrology better than you probably. So I'm going to give you my information, and then I'm going to say, now I'm not sure exactly how that works out for you. It could work out in this way and this way and this way and this way. And generally the first couple things I say are pretty much exactly how it goes. But I don't want to assume that I know the entirety of the story or that I know how you're going to react to that. So I try to give people as much power, much of their power back as I can. When people come to me and ask me to, you know, like, give them the answer or solve their problem, which doesn't happen that much because I don't think I attract that clientele. But I want to give people that. Like, don't give yourself away to a stranger. Like, you know yourself better than anybody else, but I've got this whole Rubik's cube of information for you, and let's start to unlock it. And I want to give you key phrases and ideas and archetypes to work with that help you to understand yourself better and your own nature, and to see why something might be threatening or painful or difficult, or really easy for you. And then I want to say, like, oh my God, you've got these gifts. They're so amazing. Like, please don't take these for granted. This is what you're supposed to do. Like, most people come to me and they're like, what should I do? And I say, A, B, C. And they're like, that's what I've always wanted to do. And I always say, you don't need an astrologer. Like, everyone already knows what's in them. So as somebody who's got another piece of their puzzle, I just want to offer that back to you. I just want to give you back you and what you already know about yourself, most likely. But there's something there's something really wild that happens when a stranger, you're not even in the room with me, you're on Skype with me or over the phone, when I start talking about the details of your life in really, you know, intimate ways that I shouldn't know about. And how do I do that? Well, that's not because I'm psychic, because I don't work that way. Some people do, but I don't. It's because I'm reading something. I'm literally like reading, it's almost like sentences to me. Like I'm looking at something and I'm just interpreting a language. So it's almost like I have a book of your life and I'm just reading lines off of it. And I don't know why astrology works. I don't know anybody that could explain why.
Mm-hmm. And we could try and it would be fun, but it's like, geez, it works. And isn't that great?
Yeah. Yeah. I always say, like, I have the weirdest, most amazing job where I get to sit and talk to strangers about like really intimate, deep details of their life. And so if that is true, if you can go to a stranger and they can tell you things that no one should really know but you, then there must be some sort of conversation that we are in with the cosmos. There must be something intelligent at work in the universe. And if that is so, what is it telling me now? Where is it guiding me? Mm-hmm. And then that's how you unfold the chart. So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, that is so beautiful.
It is. Yeah. My heart is exploding. Jenny, I love that you talk about the archetypes. You brought that up. You help people connect to parts of themselves and understand their own experiences and reactions through using archetypes and myths, things that we share in our collective consciousness as a species, and beyond the species also. I have been really fascinated by your use of archetypes in your work. Can you tell us more about the connection between these archetypes and the planets and how they manifest for the folks that
serve? Great cosmic conversation?
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's a piece of it where, of course, like the Greco-Roman pantheon has been heavily placed upon the planets, which is a form of colonization, right? Like we can look at how colonized the sky has become because it's full of mostly white guys. tales, right? Which, like, I'm not cool with. But so there's that level of it. And yet the Greco-Roman pantheon is beautiful and full of so much wisdom and grace and gorgeousness and poetry and really important archetypes. And every culture has their own set of archetypes and their own way of relating. And so it's one of these things that I straddle where I don't want to be proliferating upon like a white Western idealization of what a god or goddess or archetype is. So I try to like move the archetypes around and also give that to people to say, like, if in your own pantheon or your own way of seeing, your own cultural, religious, spiritual way of seeing things, if there is an archetype of the wounded healer or of the mother or of the sea god or goddess, or, you know, like try to open it up in ways like that. And then there are some really interesting central themes that I will pull out in different contexts. I'll see like when it's most applicable, because there's always something in the story, because all of the stories of the Greco-Roman gods and goddesses, they all go back further to like Mesopotamia and Northern Africa. And they're all later proliferations of ancient gods and goddesses. Mostly goddesses. Or, you know, the goddesses held a whole different kind of space in our consciousness, and then the patriarchy came in and subverted it. So I also find it really interesting to study the history of mythology, because you get to see politically what was happening to the consciousness and how they used, like we always do, the myth of the cultures at that time to inundate people and to explain away why it was okay to rape and pillage and steal and subvert and take power.
So to retell the story is to bring power back into people's own hands.
I think so. Yeah, it's like to reclaim this. Let's look at the origins of where we get this thought from.
On that
or
note,
this archetype.
Yeah. I had really enjoyed listening to a talk you did on Lilith, and I had actually at the time been she had been just showing up in my consciousness a lot. And I don't know if this is still pertinent for you, so feel free to toss it if it's stale. But for listeners who may be unfamiliar, can you give us a little background on Lilith?
Sure.
Yeah.
Lilith. I love Lilith.
Me too.
A lot of Jews would be like, what are you talking about? Because I went to Paris this summer and saw a lot of the old amulets that ward Lilith off. And Lilith was, probably one of the minor reasons why she was brought into the myth is that they needed a reason for why babies died. Like, why would God take babies? Mm-hmm. And so they had to come up with an evil entity that would come and kill babies. And so Lilith took the brunt of that. So she was this baby killer demon screech owl that would roam around at night and crawl into your bed with your husband and get him hard and then take his sperm and then spawn thousands of demon babies every night. And she was like this unstoppable force of fear. And like, she had this insatiable sexual appetite. Mm-hmm. Like she was the woman that lives on the outskirts. So what's her origin? And like to go into her origin story is fascinating because it so articulates our fear of the night, of the other, of the creation of quote unquote other, of othering. I think it's like she points to the roots of separation.
Mm, exile.
And her myth and like how she comes across in the Midrash and the stories that the rabbis tell. Like they are terrified of her. And, she's the first wife of Adam and she, she's in the, in the beginning, Adam was both male and female and then got lonely because it saw the goats having fun. And then so Adam was like, hey, God, like, check it out. I would love a partner. And so God splits Adam down the middle. And this is where we get the beginning of the problem is that then it's said that Lilith is made from the filth and the sediment of the earth. And Adam's made from the rest of the good stuff of the earth. Because Adama means red earth, means like the mother earth clay of creation. So they start to quarrel and talk about like they wanted to name things differently. And then they go to have sex and she's like, great, lay down. I'm going to ride you. And Adam goes, what are you talking about? You can't do that. You're beneath me. So you have to lay beneath me. And she was like, my friend, I am so sorry. I don't know who told you this lie.
I will see you never.
Yeah, brother, you and I were born at the same time. Like, we were one person. What? And the first person being androgyne and the God being multi-gendered or not gendered at mm-hmm. all, and the first human being both genders or no gender or multiple genders or, like this whole idea of gender and separation.
Totally outside of our conventional duality.
Yeah, and this is where the beginning, I'm not going to say that that's the beginning of her story is the beginning of it, but it's when it gets cemented into consciousness that I think is interesting. Like, okay, then it gets written into the text. Then there's Talmud, writings about her that are saying this is a blasphemous woman. This is so what happens is she says, Adam, I can't live with somebody who doesn't think that I'm their equal. Mm. And Adam says, well, you're not. And so she calls God and she says God's secret name. So it's blasphemous in Judaism to say God's name, right? You don't say mm-hmm. the name of God. But she's like, brother, I know your name and I know your secret name and I am not afraid to use it. Like, I will not be tamed by you. I am older than you because I existed before you and I will exist after you and I will not be tamed.
And I won't let you tell me that I'm less.
Yeah. I won't stay. I will go to the ends of the earth. I will live in the desert. I will live on the perimeter. I will be in the liminal spaces. Mm. And so that's what she does. She flees. She runs. She exiles herself. And she goes out into the desert. And then she gets blamed for everything.
Great.
Then she becomes the demon, the baby killer, the... the the erotic succubus that comes at night, and you know, so the husband can't, you know, sleep by himself, and it's this whole thing about monogamy and gender and female sexuality being evil and bad and something to be tamed. And it's also a warning story. Ladies, if you live outside the boundary of the garden, you will be an outcast and you will not be in the clan anymore.
Mm-hmm. And you will be a monster, feared and hated.
Yeah. Yeah. But the cool thing is the rabbis, they could write any story about her, but God cannot destroy Lilith. God can't just take Lilith out. She's too powerful. She is part of life. So Judaism is really deep and it's really nuanced, even though it can seem really super problematic on the surface. Hmm. She also becomes, in some ways, and it gets really kind of odd, but in the Kabbalistic things, it's like she also becomes God's lover or like his, you know, his mistress in a way. There's like these nuances of how she's interacting with the above and the below and how they still mingle and swap out. And she has to exist because she is the counterpart to an all-knowing, all-pervasive Father God. There's got to be a counterpoint to that.
Interesting.
To the super, super white light. There has to be something to balance that.
That darkness that complements it.
It has to exist. Yeah. Anyway, I could talk about her
for Oh my gosh, me too. I've been thinking about her nonstop for weeks and weeks.
Barbara Kultuf.
What is that?
Barbara Kultuf wrote the Book of Lilith.
Awesome. I will be reading that.
She's very peripheral. Yeah.
I love that you mentioned that Lilith was depicted as a sexual being, which is evil in this context of the stories people would tell about her. And that kind of sheds some light on, you know, obviously sexuality has been broken down and curtailed and squashed in all these ways in our culture. And I perceive a connection to the feminine and a connection to nature. You know, not only is it wrong to be sexual, but our culture regularly dismisses, like, the fecund life happening all around us in nature, the sexuality that is constantly, you step outside your door, birds are singing, flowers are blooming, they're having sex. And so I think, I'm kind of curious, do you perceive a relationship between the way that nature is sort of exiled from our culture and sexuality is exiled from our culture and femininity has been squashed in our culture? And the myth of Lilith, how can we bring those things together through Lilith as a lens?
Well, we have to remember that Lilith is God comes late on the scene. You know, like this idea of a male God that is above and is all-knowing, that's like way down the road. And for thousands and thousands of years, we have all of these goddesses. We have a mother creator and gods and, you know, the the orgiastic goings on of the gods and goddesses. It was all sex all the time. Yeah. That's how everything came into being. And so in order to get across this male monotheistic situation, you had to shut it down. And so Lilith in those stories that I'm talking about is really far down the line in our written history, even in our, you know, even in our artistic history. And so she is just like the shadow, the remnants of these long lineages of very sexual goddesses and big-hipped, big-breasted, pregnant, ripe with life, because they were reflections of nature and because sex and sexuality wasn't separate necessarily for a long time in many situations all over the world. And gender wasn't necessarily, you know, conflated in the way that it was or became in life. So the roles were different and sex was a part of ritual, which was a part of religion, which was a part of all of it. And so, yeah, all that separation had to happen.
Monotheistic culture to prevail.
Yeah, unfortunately. Although, I have to also say, as a Jew, like, I have to say, like, you know, Judaism talks a lot about taking care of the earth and taking care of the animals and being a good person and making sure that we're in line with the cycles of life. So also not to, like, you know, it was a big break in a lot of ways, but it's nuanced and there's a lot of different sides to it.
The intention is certainly not to defer to alternative dualities.
Right. And there was a lot of multiplicity in different ways of expressing Judaism too. That got lost. And because of anti-Semitism, what had to happen to certain areas where Judaism was practiced and how it had to become purified, or purified, quote unquote, or, you know, it had to remove itself from its other lineages and its other ways of being. Even astrologically, like Jews, rabbis were, there were some really famous rabbis who were astrologers in ancient days, but you won't hear many rabbis say that these days.
Oh, wow.
Very interesting. Yeah.
So it's how, you know, it's like all of our origins, if we dig back into the history of it, like, what was it back in the day? Like, what was it really like? And what did we have to lose in order to, quote unquote, have this progress?
So we live in this culture now where you're speaking about people having to curtail their practices of astrology or, you know, rituals, rites, things that we could possibly broadly categorize as, quote, magic. And so in our modern culture, you know, that's like a bad word almost, and a good word. We have Harry Potter. Yeah. We have all these representations in the media of magic happening. But if you start to talk about an intuitive practice, I think a lot of folks, they will clam up and get really scared. And I wonder if you have any advice for folks who are just sort of starting to experience themselves as intuitive.
Well, the one thing about it is I don't really consider myself an intuitive. Like, I'm an astrologer, which is something that I do. Intuition has a way of being with that, or I definitely use it. So there's that piece of it. There's another piece of it where, of course, we, especially as femmes, as female-identified folks, as women, as, you know, anything on the gender spectrum of feminine, female, we have been burned at the stake. We have been thrown in jail. We have been historically hunted, and having our connection to the earth, to if we want to call it magic or intuition, or you know, working with the elements of the earth, the planets, the natural world, that has been literally scared out of us in a lot of ways. And so there's an aspect of reclaiming and understanding our history, the context of what was, how witches, how astrologers, how healers were regarded in our own specific cultures, and then in the culture soup that we live in, and how we relate to those archetypes. Because it's easier to shut it down than to live in danger, right? So historically, we've come out of some really intense dark ages where you were burned at the stake in, you know, in a lot of places for practicing anything that you knew that was your tradition, that was your culture. I always think it's really important to understand our history and where, depending on our own cultural lineage, our own religious, our own spiritual lineages, how magic, how healing, how astrology, how systems of divination is viewed within our own cultural context, because we each come with a different system. We each come with a different experience of it. Some of us have grandmothers, aunties, uncles, you know, moms that do it, and we're okay with it. And some of us come with this kind of shame, or like this needing, like our culture, our people needed to hide that part of themselves in order to survive. A lot of us come from, you know, parents that just wanted to fit in to the culture that they either moved to or didn't quite fit into, but that had to hide anything, quote unquote, weird or strange or out of the norm about them or us, or any of the, again, cultural things that we come from. So I always think understanding the root, the history of how our people practiced in accordance with the elements and with the earth, practice any kind of magic or divination or healing systems. And then we can get a better sense of how that might appear in ourselves and why we might be afraid of it. I want to say that it's more than just intuition. These are skills that were passed down, or skills that we know about. Even being, you know, working with herbs, working with tinctures, working, being a midwife, being a doula. Like, these are things that are deep in our memory. Mm-hmm. And again, culturally in different specific ways, but these are deep things that we know in our body because that's what we did for so long. Mm. Or the different places that we held, depending on where we fell in the gender spectrum in our own cultures historically, there was room for lots of different types of genders in different places in different times in history. And what did colonization do? How did that erode that? How did, you know, all of these things kind of come together to make us want to forget what we know, to make us want to distance ourselves from what is natural to us. And so if Lilith can teach us anything, it's that, for one, we can survive on the outskirts. That's not that's not a problem. But for two, you know, we also want more for ourselves than only ever being on the periphery. That is also a lonely tale. And we don't want to be, like, you know, being demonized is not a fun situation. Being ostracized isn't the greatest thing. But we can do it if we need to. We can survive it. But that she teaches, when she goes back into the garden, she reappears, I believe. This is my own. I shared it with other academics that study her much deeper than I do. But I believe that she reappears in the garden as the snake, right? And wrapped around the tree of knowledge, and she offers Eve, her counterpart or the second wife, a sister wife. she's like, hey, Eve, take this apple from my tree of knowledge. Do not forget me. Do not forget where you come from. Girl, you can't stay here. Yeah. These people won't let you grow. They won't let you live. You will not come into consciousness and into your own. Mm. And so Eve incorporates the ancient wisdom into herself, into her cellular self, and gets blasted out into the real world where she will develop herself because she has to leave the womb. We all have to leave that, you know, utopia to find our way through. And so Lilith is this, she's like reincarnates as the snake to say, I am that kundalini possibly energy, or I am that source of ancient snake energy. I am the original goddess energy that says, I will give you vision and I will give you knowledge, but you can't have it by staying safe. So it's okay to leave. You might cry a little bit.
Yes.
So is there any way that you connect with the earth to kind of awaken that knowledge? Or, you know, is like she offered an apple, which is a very physical representation of the earth in one way and also represents so many other things. But does earth connection play into your own practice of that?
Yeah, I mean, I need to see green things. I need to be – I live by the ocean and I lived in New York City last year, and – while I am part New Yorker, it's where my people come from, the cement was too much for my system.
Yeah.
Like, I need to know, I need to have that energetic exchange with green and varieties of, you know, earth beings that on a daily basis where I can feel, where my body can feel like it's connected to nature. I grew up in a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful part of the world in British Columbia, Canada.
Oh, wow.
In a tiny town in the Rocky Mountains. And that sense of being connected to something majestic and natural is something that's always held me and really, I think, parented me in a lot of ways and kept me connected to something, a source of goodness. Mm-hmm. So I need that. I might not like ritualize it every day or do it consciously, but I have to walk in the grass and just, I have to just be close to it.
I mean, you moved all the way, you know, you moved away from what wasn't serving you into what was in that environmental respect.
Moved a lot.
So how can connecting with nature help us understand and implement astrological guidance?
Well, certainly like having a relationship with something as simple as the movements of the sun and the moon, like really being aware of like the way the sun moves through the sky in the winter and the summer is very different. And the light it casts is different. The way it hits our eyes is different. The quality of colors are different. The way the moon is a very obvious thing to follow because it's, we can see it at different times during the cycle and we can watch that cycle. And those are two anchors that we have. And those are the two really prominent parts of the chart that we always look at. Like when I look at a chart, I look at the ascendant, the ruler of the ascendant, the sun and the moon. But the sun and the moon are, you know, primary because they are the lights. They are the places of life. And when I'm looking at a chart, I want to know, are the planets, the life forces in the chart, are they doing well? So you can think of like the dance of the sun and moon and really start to wonder like what cycle was I born under? What part of the moon cycle was I born under? Because that is a whole, you know, level of understanding of our seed potential and what we're doing with it as we understand the cycle of the moon and the quality of light and what, you know, how rapidly the light sheds or the way in which the light wanes with the moon. And when the full moon is in the sky, the sun and the moon appear to be the same size and you can see them both in the sky at the same time. It's this phenomenon, really. Mm-hmm. For that moment, the sun and the moon are equal. And are you born at that phase of the moon? Like it's, and what that means. And so when you can watch the sky and then, you know, Venus is really easy to see even in really intense light cities. Venus, sometimes Mars, Jupiter at certain points. So if you just follow like really simple blogs like Skywatch or, you know, there's certain astronomical blogs that you can get like what are the most visible planets this month, and then see like get up and look at them and look at the morning sky, look at the evening sky, see what's going on, and you'll start to understand the myths that are associated with those planets and why. Venus is the brightest star besides the sun and moon, and so she's a great benefic, like she's a planet that brings beauty, love, connection, good things because she's bright, she's got light. Mars appears red, so the ancients were like, I don't know about that.
Looks like blood.
So it's not like it doesn't have a place in the universe, but I'm going to be a little wary of that.
The aggro planet.
Yeah, you know. So there's reasons why we get the qualities of the planets. They are alive in the sky, and they are doing all these amazing things all year long. So that's one way nature can connect us to astrology, because astrology is nature.
Hmm. Very cool and powerful, yeah.
I have heard you talk about the power of declaring, Jenny, in reference to your own values, your passions, and your identity, kind of following your gut through the fog and letting pieces fall into place. Can you tell us about how you've witnessed that power of declaring in your own life?
Well, declaring is important for me in order to set containers for myself. So I declared, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that I would write weekly, well, I think at the time it was monthly horoscopes. And then so that I just had to do it. So there's a way that like declare, and I didn't want to all the time. And I, you know, struggled with it and didn't think I was any good at it. And it was a really, you know, it was an intense growth spurt for me and growing edge. But there's a way that declaring, I declare something and then I have to grow into it. So I'm big on what I'm growing into, and that there's nothing as complete in any of those stages, but I need to set the stage for something and then move towards it, grow into it, and then grow beyond it probably. Or, you know, what am I also growing out of? And so those are declarations. I'm growing out of this paradigm. I'm growing out of self-doubt. I'm growing out of, you know, fear around this thing. I'm growing out of relationships that keep me hindered to not very good circumstances, whatever the thing is. I think the declaring that helps the mind go, oh, okay, that's what we're doing. Then I better find a way to do that and get on board the intuition and the unconscious and all the other faculties that I have that I probably don't consciously use all the time. But once I've declared something, all systems are like, oh, I got the message. And then something in me has got to move towards that because I said it. And if I say it publicly, then I really am held to it. And then I have to go through the fire that it takes to get there. But eventually I'll get there. Because I said it, I declared it.
I love that.
I have to show up.
That little sort of self-initiation, going through the fire, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm good at that. I kick and scream on the way there, but I'm good at declaring.
Oh, but you tell such a wonderful story on the way there, too, and we love it. We just love it.
Oh, so this, I just came up with this question, and I don't know if it's even possible, if it makes sense to you, but but I'd love to ask, and if it's nonsense, just tell me. But have you ever given or could you give an astrology reading for the Earth itself?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. There's something called the Thema Mundi, and it is the symbolic chart of the world. It's like the chart for the soul of the world, we could say.
Cool.
And the Thema Mundi, which a lot of astrologers will know about, is the like template for which many of the astrological principles of ancient, traditional, whatever you want to call it, Hellenistic, medieval astrology is based off of, or at least references. And so there's this essential nature of the chart of the earth itself. It is, of course, a intuited principle. So, you know, like we can talk forever about where it came from, but it is, it just like appeared and it's something that we've had, and it works as a template for everything else. And so when you unpack the chart for the soul of the world, you then get all of these amazing theories and understandings about light and consciousness and how different planets work and why different signs work in the way they do. And it's this wildly simple and amazingly intricate chart and way of looking at life through the lens of astrology.
Wow, that sounds really cool.
So you can use that in terms of like when things happen on the earth, you can look at, you could look at that. I've seen astrologers use it in terms of interpreting stuff that's happening.
Cool. Wow. Well, this was an amazing conversation. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come hang out and answer our questions.
Yeah. I just have so many books I want to go read now. And I'm just like, I'm more and more in love with Lilith every day.
Go read, get the Book of Lilith for sure.
Yeah, I definitely will.
So where can people find you and more about you?
So people can find me at channinicholas.com, channinicholas.com. And I give monthly new moon sessions. They're like intention settings. I go through the astrology for the lunar cycle, like day by day. I go through each sign, each rising sign, what the lunar cycle holds for you or what's the most important thing. And I focus on where the new moon is happening in each sign's chart. So if you know your rising sign, you can look at it and see specifically where it's happening in your chart. I help people set intentions, not by telling them what intentions to set, but by offering writing exercises to help kind of get to the core of the root of the issue that might be standing in their way in terms of what they're trying to call into their life. And so I'm working on a kind of psychological, spiritual level with people where you can use the work in whatever way it suits you to help you set intentions for the cycles. And then I've also got astrology for the year ahead. There's a booklet for like the general overview of the astrology for the year and then how it relates to your sign specifically. And then it's also got a recording that comes to you. So it's like having a reading with me in a sense, like 40 to 50 minutes long. Oh, and then I'm doing something called Living Your Purpose, where I'm going to take people through their chart, their sun, moon, and ascendant ruler for 21 days. And so every day you'll get something in your inbox and there'll be discussions. And it's going to teach people to understand the core of their chart and get way more information than they would get if they just got a reading from me.
Cool.
So I'm really into like empowering people to use astrology for themselves. And just by learning those couple of tools, you can understand a vast amount about your chart.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that.
And I have done, Channy, I did your new moon in Scorpio and it was so lovely. And I really appreciated how you do focus on connecting people to their own experience as opposed to just inserting some kind of imperative. So thanks for that.
Yeah, thank you. That was an intense moon.
Wow. Yeah, it was. I have Scorpio rising, so I was like, let's get on this train. Woo!
Yeah, that was also the first Saturn square Neptune.
That'll be happening, won't it, for a while?
Yeah, the world kind of fell apart. So yeah, it was an intense cycle.
Is Black Moon Lilith taking prominence in our skies right now? Did I make that up?
Well, right now, I'm just looking. Where is she right now? I know in the new year, she's in Scorpio, so she's still in she's in Scorpio while we're having the Mars and her are going to meet up in Scorpio very soon.
Oh, goodness. Well, I better get my stuff together.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about that. I was like, what am I going to write about that?
Oh, my gosh.
I'll be reading it, Channy.
Yeah.
Tell you what.
Are there any other offerings or anything that you're, any special things you got going on? It sounds like you have a lot of offerings,
there's
which
a lot.
Is awesome.
A lot going on. Yeah, I'm going to do a Saturn return call help people understand their Saturn return soon, like a course. I'll do that. And then we've got some other things in the works, and we'll be letting them out soon. But those are the next couple of things that I'm doing.
Hmm. Excellent. Yeah. And that was...
Yeah, and there'll be a Mars. There'll be something, because Mars is going to go retrograde in 2016. It'll be a big thing. So I'll take people through like a six-week course around it.
When do you sleep?
And when she's sleeping, she's talking to asteroids. Natalie.
I know. She's a hard-working lady.
Yeah, she is. Yeah.
I need to schedule. I do schedule vacations, which I have to.
Good.
Wonderful.
Good.
Yeah. Boundaries.
Boundaries.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Boundaries. Yeah. For sure.
Well, thank you. And have an awesome New Year's.
Mwah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Lots of luck.
Thank you so much for listening. You can show your gratitude and help others find these conversations by subscribing and leaving a review on iTunes or whatever app you're listening through.
Leaving a review will help us grow this network of earth lovers and intuitive-minded folks. You can also help us share these conversations by liking our Dream Freedom Beauty page and sharing your favorite episode on Facebook. For exclusive content and rewards, support us on Patreon.
Thank you so much, and until next time, many blessings.